From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. With the House Intelligence Committee investigation into Russian interference in the election bogged down in controversy, today the Senate Intelligence Committee is holding its first public hearing on the topic. Committee Chairman Richard Burr, a Republican, said Russians have been trying to undermine U.S. interests for many years.
The takeaway from today's hearing, we're all targets of a sophisticated and capable adversary, and we must engage in a whole-of-government approach to combat Russian active measures.
Ranking Democrat Mark Warner focused on Russian disinformation campaigns and hacking in the 2016 election.
Russia sought to hijack our democratic process, and that most important part of our democratic process, our presidential elections. As we'll learn today, Russia's strategy and tactics are not new, but their brazenness certainly was.
Joining us now is NPR national security correspondent Phil Ewing. Hi, Phil.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And how different is this hearing from what we saw in the House?
It's quite a bit different. The Senate leaders, Mr. Burr and Mr. Warner, who we just heard from there, want to really make the case that they're the adults, for lack of a better term. They're the grown-ups. They're going to have a sedate, kind of stentorian, very Senate-like process as they investigate last year's election meddling, which stands in pretty stark contrast to the one taking place in the other chamber of Congress, the House, which has kind of become this bizarre sideshow with charges and countercharges between its two top members after some accusations by the Republican House Chairman Devin Nunes about information he'd uncovered that said the Trump transition team had been swept up in foreign surveillance by the United States, and a call by the top Democrat Adam Schiff of California for Nunes to recuse himself. And that's not what's taking place in the Senate. Instead, they're kind of in a very lawyerly fashion making a case, hearing from expert witnesses today, and laying the foundation for what they say will be a much more formal process.
Well, let's listen here to a little more from today's hearing. This is Florida Republican Senator Marco Rubio questioning a panel of expert witnesses.
Are we in danger here because we are focused on a very important tactical move that happened in the election of 2016 to miss the broader point? And that is that this is a coordinated effort across multiple spectrums to sow instability and to pit Americans against one another politically, socioeconomically, demographically, and the like.
Did Republicans today mainly steer clear of questions about any connections between the Trump campaign or Trump associates and Russia and really focus more on the bigger question of Russian interference in the election and beyond?
That's right. That's where they want this to focus. Republicans want to steer this away from what did Trump aides during the campaign do or say to Russians during the campaign, and was there any foreknowledge about Russia's activities or coordination between the two sides. Instead, they want to focus, as we heard from Senator Rubio there, on the big picture that the Russians used this term. We also heard Senator Burr use active measures during the 2016 campaign, the stealing of information that embarrassed Democrats in Hillary Clinton's campaign, the use of bots on Twitter or trolls on Twitter to get into battles with people and try and quiet supporters for Democrats. And they say that could happen again. Part of the outcome of this congressional process is to try to prepare for the 2018 campaign, the 2020 campaign, and all the other presidential and political contests that are taking place in the Western world, all of which Russia seeks to disrupt if it can.
Now, we're talking today about the Senate Intelligence Committee and also the House Intelligence Committee investigation. Some people say take it away from both of those in a sense and just form an independent commission to investigate. And we can add two more names to that list today. We spoke with former Democratic Congressman Lee Hamilton, who was chair of the 9/11 Commission, and former Republican Senator Richard Lugar. Let's listen here. Here's Congressman Hamilton.
It seems to me the partisanship is very high in the Congress, and the chances of getting a decent result, not very high.
So he says he wants an independent commission, and here's Senator Lugar.
It appears to me that he is attempting to protect the president, and so I wish that he would step aside.
He's talking there about the House Intelligence Committee Chair Devin Nunes. Is there likely to be an independent commission? Does it look like the momentum is building?
The odds are very slight. This is something that would require action by the Republican leader in the Senate, Mitch McConnell, and the Republican Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, and eventually create a process that could pose a big danger to their ally, the President Donald Trump, who's a fellow Republican. And that's why it doesn't appear very likely that they would get behind this based on the evidence that's out there now. It's entirely possible that these investigations, including the one being undertaken by the FBI, could uncover some kind of explosive new evidence that makes this so hot and so dangerous for Republicans, they have no choice but to create one of these panels. But in terms of the politics in Washington, we're not there yet, and they will probably let these play out under the regular committee so far.
And we'll be watching these hearings. Phil Ewing, NPR National Security Correspondent, thanks so much as always.
My pleasure.
Well, now, look up. The FAA says it expects drone sales to climb from 2.5 million last year to 7 million in 2020. That's a lot of drones in the air. And across the country, flight instructors are working to make sure drone operators use these remote-controlled machines safely and follow federal rules. Brian Bull from member station KLCC reports on one effort in Eugene, Oregon.
All right, Mr. Bob. Great to see you.
At Eugene Toy and Hobby in Eugene, Oregon, manager Mark Agutter shows off shelves of brightly colored drones.
The most popular one is a Dromeda Kodo HD. The HD camera this year was an innovation, an upgrade by them.
Drones here can sell from $35 to $1,000, depending on size, power, and accessories.
They're extremely easy to fly compared to airplanes or helicopters, for example. You know, you take it off from a standing start on the ground. You don't have to be going at 50, 60, 70 miles an hour. A lot of them come with cameras or visual equipment, so it just adds another feature of interest for a lot of people.
But some air traffic controllers and pilots like Mary Rosenblum are wary of the flying machine's popularity. She recalls a near miss in 2012 as she flew her single-engine Cessna out of a small airport near Portland.
I had a glimpse of a bright, shiny green object that zipped past me, missing my wing on the right by about 6 inches. I was 1,000 feet above the ground.
The FAA says they average 100 reports of drones in controlled airspace a month. Rosenblum says drone operators need to exercise common sense and a general awareness of their environment.
There's no reason that drones and aircraft should cause problems for one another, but it really will make it a much more compatible coexistence if the people who are operating drones have an understanding of where aircraft are and where they're not.
Enter Brandon Wynn. He's a flight instructor at Lane Community College, a job that often takes him here to the Eugene Airport. He helps teach a brand new class on drones.
Now this guy, you can also upgrade the motors on it, and you can get this guy booking 30, 40 miles an hour.
Wynn maneuvers a drone across a conference room. It's about the size of a Frisbee. Some consumer models can weigh up to 55 pounds and require two people to carry them. Regardless of size, Wynn says,
for all practical purposes, it is still an airplane in the air. It is still something that can cause deaths if you're not careful.
Collisions with windshields, engines, rotors, or wings can be dangerous to pilots, passengers, and people below. Wynn says the FAA released new regulations last summer that should help cut the potential for accidents.
They allowed UAS to fly all the way up to 400 feet, and you have to stay outside of 5 miles of any airport. The FAA has come out with a really awesome app for the phones. It's called Before You Fly, and it'll take weather, location, and a few other factors in there, daylight even, and it'll tell you, yes, you're good to fly.
Wynn hopes the students learn the do's and don'ts of drone operation. News reports through the years have included stories of rescue copters and fire planes having to divert away from drones hovering in their path. At Lane Community College's downtown campus, students learn drone basics and FAA regulations. Co-instructor Sean Parrish shares one called Part 107.
Which allows for commercial operations of small unmanned aerial systems. The big reason for that is it has allowed a lot of photographers and other professionals to utilize drones for making money.
That business angle is what drew many students here, including Matthew Corson Finnerty. He's taking the class to help him better market his bike shop called Bike Friday.
What I'm really excited to do is to be able to use a drone to capture our bicycles in motion, to be able to fly alongside someone as they're cycling, or to be able to go up into the sky and get a nice downward shot of them riding.
And Zach Erdman is a home inspector and energy auditor. He says he'll use drones in his work.
And not actually putting myself up on a roof of a house with icy roofs and snow cover. I figured this would be a great way to introduce myself to this kind of technology and see if it's something that we can incorporate into our business.
And hobbyists like Dan Scheidel just want to learn the basics of safety, privacy, and security.
Don't fly near emergency areas, or you can't fly in national parks. Just follow the rules so you don't ruin the fun for the rest of us. Don't be that guy.
This land was made for you and me.
Even Lady Gaga is abiding by the rules. Her Super Bowl halftime show featured hundreds of drones doing synchronized maneuvers. Turns out they were all pre-recorded well before the coin toss. The FAA prohibits drones within a 35-mile radius of any stadium hosting the big game. For Here and Now, I'm Brian Bull in Eugene, Oregon.
Thank you, Brian. Anytime we can fit Lady Gaga into a piece, we will. It's Here and Now. There's a new Donald Trump ad that sounds a lot like the old Donald Trump ads.
America must put its own citizens first, because only then can we truly make America great again.
The ad is funded by the nonprofit group Making America Great, which is headed by Rebecca Mercer, who's been called the first lady of the alt-right. She's credited with maneuvering Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway onto the Trump campaign when it first faltered. Both Bannon and Conway worked for organizations funded by Rebecca's father, hedge fund billionaire Robert Mercer. So who are the Mercers? Well, for one thing, Robert Mercer is also funding one of the leading climate change deniers, Arthur Robinson. And he said that African Americans were better off economically before the civil rights movement, that Hillary Clinton participated in a drug running plot out of Mena, Arkansas, and that both Clintons are murderers. Robert Mercer funds anti-Hillary groups, including the one that made the anti-Hillary film Citizens United, the center of the Supreme Court decision which removed limits on how much corporations and nonprofits and individuals like Bob Mercer can spend on federal elections. And his $10 million investment in the alt-right Breitbart News gave it flight. In fact, journalist Jane Mayer makes the case in The New Yorker that Bob Mercer got Donald Trump into the Oval Office. She joins us now. And Jane, Trump voters are probably saying, yes, Mercer did, and he did it brilliantly.
I am hearing that. I mean, one of the people I interviewed for the article was Steve Bannon, and I haven't heard from him directly, but I've heard through the grapevine that he felt the story was a good story in some ways, in that it shows the really larger-than-life role that he played when he connected up with the Mercer family and helped channel their fortune into political projects that helped launch Trump.
So you can look at this through two prisms. Let's just go straight at it. Who is Robert Mercer, the CEO of, as you report, one of the most profitable hedge funds in the U.S., computer scientist, somebody into analogs and data, and not very verbal?
Well, he is described as really something of a computer and math genius. He's now 70 years old, but he has been behind a couple breakthroughs in the computer world. The first one was figuring out how to translate languages on computers. So it was the beginning of Google's translation programs and some of the things that brought us things like Siri. And after that, he figured out how to use computers to take masses of data in the stock market and boil them down in ways that would help predict where the market's going so that his firm, Renaissance Technologies, could make extra smart trades. And so in many ways, they've outsmarted the stock market, and the place is just minting billions of dollars.
Well, there's that. He also, in his involvement in politics, benefited greatly from the Citizens United Supreme Court decision, which allowed more money into politics. And there's a pattern here. He was a major investor in the group that made the film.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you take a look at Bob Mercer's politics, he is way out on the far right fringe of America. And he believes that he should be able to use his fortune to try to impose his views on the country.
But address right now people who might be thinking, but other people do that on the left. George Soros invests in things that he believes in and people he believes in.
They definitely do. And they've been able to do it much more since the Citizens United decision from the Supreme Court in 2010. Bob Mercer happens to have been especially successful at it recently because he invested in a number of ways and a number of projects that really, behind the scenes, helped launch Trump. And that is a statement that was made by Steve Bannon to me in this story. He says that no other donor has come close to the impact that the Mercer families had in building the foundation for the what he calls the Trump Revolution.
Talk about some of the groups that he invested in.
Yeah, well, a lot of what, it's interesting, in addition to putting $22.5 million just into campaigns in 2016, including the Trump campaign, what the Mercer family did was kind of a longer view investment in companies and organizations that were trying to undermine the mainstream media. So they invested in Breitbart News, and they also invested in and started something called the Government Accountability Institute. And what it did was it dug up dirt on political figures that they didn't like, including Hillary Clinton. And it produced a book that became a major bestseller called Clinton Cash. The Government Accountability Institute succeeded in giving a copy of it to the New York Times early, which took that exclusive access to turn it into a front page story, which gave credibility to the whole idea that Hillary Clinton was a corrupt figure.
Well, we remember this moment. It was sort of an embarrassing journalistic moment, but were the claims true?
Well, I think probably some of the claims are true. Sometimes you can have a slant that doesn't mean that the story is completely wrong, but it may be lacking context. For instance, the Clintons may have done things. She may have definitely given those speeches to Goldman Sachs, but when you take a look at what Trump was doing, well, we now have a government that's filled with people who worked at Goldman Sachs. So does that make her especially corrupt? There's a question of context that's missing.
Much of the comments about Mercer come from people that he worked with at Renaissance Technologies. One of them, David Magerman, who told you that Mercer very much believes that if someone is on welfare, they have negative value. Someone earns 1,000 times more than a school teacher, then he's 1,000 times more valuable. But what are your biggest questions about him? In other words, are there illegalities?
Well, my questions coming into this story were, I knew that the Mercers had a tremendous amount of influence, but they don't give interviews. So my question coming into this was, who are these people and what do they really believe? And what kinds of places are they trying to take America? And what he thinks is extraordinary. It's the first time I've ever come across anyone who has been arguing that the nuclear bombs dropped on the Japanese in World War II were actually in some ways healthy for the Japanese because the radiation from it outside of the blast zone, he believes, was good for the Japanese. It's not a position that the National Academy of Sciences, for instance, backs up. You hear many people with big money, particularly fossil fuel industry people, who will say that global warming is not really happening or that people are not really causing it. He endorses that point of view, too. But he takes it to a further extreme and suggests that global warming is really great for everybody and that plant life and animal life are going to be better off. Again, it's a position that you just don't find much scientific support for. Bob Mercer supports, literally is the financial supporter of the scientist who is pushing these points of view.
Well, you write that after the election, his daughter, Rebecca Mercer, was rewarded with a seat on Trump's transition team, and she is pushing Arthur Robinson, the climate change skeptic. She pushed that he be named the National Science Advisor. She pushed for John Bolton, the former ambassador to the UN, to be Secretary of State. Did not win on those counts, but do you get a sense that because of how much the Mercers lubricated with cash the path to the White House, that there's some sort of payback for them?
Well, I mean, listen, you don't have to take it from me as a reporter, though I did try very hard to be very factual in this piece. Take a listen to what the people who work with Bob Mercer say about that. David Magerman says, Bob Mercer invested in Trump, and he now owns a sizable piece of the Trump presidency. And there are other people quoted who say that they kind of bought themselves seats on the transition team by putting so much money in. So you had Rebecca Mercer on the Trump transition team, and she then recommended various hires Michael Flynn to be the national security advisor. And of course, he briefly was until he got in trouble and got fired. She also pushed very hard for Jeff Sessions to be attorney general. And that one did work.
Well, you could also say that the Mercers were prescient. They supported the, at the time, very small alt-right Breitbart News, which then
absolutely,
you know, helped the path to the White House for Donald Trump. They found Pat Caddell, the former Democratic pollster, and a data mining company that revealed what to Bob Mercer about how the electorate was feeling.
Well, what they knew early on was that there was this kind of growing populist anger in the country against elites. And so they were seeing early polling as far back as 2012 showing this. And when the Mercers were thinking about which candidates to back, they were cognizant that this kind of growing populist anger was going to be a real phenomenon in 2016.
You quote Pat Caddell about the results of their polling. He says, "It was stunning. The country was on the verge of an uprising against its leaders. I just fell over." But then, as you characterize it, here you have one of the richest men in America, Bob Mercer, paying Pat Caddell to keep collecting polling data that enabled him to exploit the public's resentment of elites such as himself.
Well, this is how I see it. I mean, I think there's an irony in the idea that you've got a man like Bob Mercer, who makes $135 million a year, according to Institutional Investor, who is looking at polling that says the public's getting mad at the idea that the rich are getting away with murder. And he's thinking, okay, well, I need to find a candidate who's going to capture that anger. And the candidate that spoke to him first was Ted Cruz. And when Cruz fell apart as a candidate, they moved to Trump, who was very much speaking in the language of populism. And it was a potent kind of message. It was a message that the polling showed would be potent, and it was.
The New Yorker's Jane Mayer. Her story is "The Reclusive Hedge Fund Tycoon Behind the Trump Presidency." It's the story of Robert Mercer. We'll post it at hearandnow.org. Jane, thank you.
Thanks for having me on.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson, and I want you to take a minute right now to think about the people you love. Have they ever listened to a podcast? Do they even know podcasts exist? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media. And if they don't know how to download a podcast, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a whole new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag Trypod. That's hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks.
And March Madness is down to the final fours. The women's semifinal games are tomorrow night in Dallas. Stanford plays South Carolina. Connecticut meets Mississippi State. South Carolina's men's team is also in the final four for the first time. The Gamecocks play Gonzaga, which is also in the four for the first time in Saturday's first semifinal. Oregon takes on North Carolina in the second game. The women's title game is Sunday night. The men's champion will be crowned Monday night in Glendale, Arizona. So there, we've set the table. Let's eat with Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst, host of the daily podcast, The Gist at Slate.com. Start with the women, UConn defending champs. You know, does Mississippi State have a, you know, is this going to, what do you think?
Yeah, you got to say they have a chance, but it's not a very good chance. I mean, Connecticut is on a triple-digit win streak, and my friends at 538 say that they have a chance in the mid-80s. It's just hard to imagine. Even Mississippi State, which pulled a great upset against Baylor, the second-best team in college basketball, to get to the Final Four, took Baylor to overtime. Tremendous achievement, but just hard to imagine how Mississippi State, or really anyone, could beat UConn. Maybe the answer is to get UConn in foul trouble, but when UConn gets in foul trouble, it's usually because the other team is playing really well, and you know, UConn could just crush your spirit, to say nothing of the team.
And I hate to even have this discussion, because you know that there are these three teams, Stanford and South Carolina, on the other side of the women's bracket, who have to go in thinking they can win, and so we're just going to say maybe they all can. Let's go to the men's. By the way, I'm going to be in North Carolina to host the program Monday from WNC. It's a station visit. Really looking forward to meeting listeners. Hope everyone is in a good mood. We could be looking at a men's championship game between North and South Carolina. So what do you see in the Final Four?
Well, as you said, we have two new entrants. Gonzaga, I think, is the class of the Final Four. They, except for the fact that maybe the perception of them, because they are from Washington State and they are a school, a small school, a Jesuit school, and they're not from a big conference. But if you actually look at their roster and their lineup, they have future NBA players. They have depth at every position. I think even the betting markets will say Gonzaga is the likeliest team to win. But we talk about those two teams in South Carolina, which have never made a Final Four. Oregon has only made one Final Four, and that was the very first Final Four when there were eight teams total invited to the NCAA tournament. It was 1939. The team was called the Tall Firs, F-I-R-S, like the tree, indigenous to Oregon, because their front line went the spectacular heights of 6'4", 6'4", and 6'8", 6'8", being the center, Slim Wintermute. So yes, technically they made a Final Four before. I don't know that the 1939 experience will inform them against North Carolina this time around.
Yeah, but still, I mean, you know, watch. Women's, men's, watch this weekend, because it's always, there's a breakout somewhere.
Yeah, and there's always so much emotion, and the losers often cry, and people find that heart-wrenching. But it is a thing that makes college basketball special. Some of these kids will never play again. They're, of course, doing it, you know, I think in a form of indentured servitude, giving how much money we make, everyone makes off it. They're doing it for free. So the passion is there, and the surprises happen.
Mike Pesca here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. One last word. I will see you UNC listeners on Sunday night for some and Monday night for others. Mike, thanks so much.
I'm sure if Duke fans want to come to the event, they can too, right?
Anybody can come.
President Trump tweeted today, "The Freedom Caucus will hurt the entire Republican agenda. We must fight them." More fallout from the failure of the Republican health care bill, which the Freedom Caucus opposed. And a reminder that even when a president's party controls both houses of Congress, getting things done isn't simple. For a look back at the history of one-party rule, let's go to Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, welcome back. And Nathan, start with this idea of one-party rule. You'd think it would be easy to get things done.
No, not at all. I mean, part of the thing that happens, I think, when you focus on, you know, one party versus another is you tend to basically overlook the fact that there are a lot of other factions and interests within the party structure that aren't simply represented by a D or an R, in our case of the 20th or 21st century. Right. You have countervailing interests in business. You have people who are lobbying as workers groups. You have all kinds of interest groups that are basically exerting influence. And in the case of this recent health care concern, you know, there were all kinds of groups that the Republicans simply thought they would get to sign on, be they doctors or formal medical lobbying groups that simply weren't on board with the Ryan Trump plan. And so I think it's really important that when we think about one party rules, such as we want to call it, that there are a variety of different interests that get buried by that notion of there being simply one party in charge.
Is that because when a party is big enough to have those kinds of majorities, they probably do have a lot of different factions in them?
That's exactly right. You do have a two-party system here. So in order to get past the finish line, to get that 51%, if you will, you've really got to put together a lot of coalitions. And really, there's been no time in American history where a majority party in Congress really didn't have a number of factions.
Well, one leader who, it seems like as you look back, was able to get things done with his majorities is FDR.
Right.
But certainly FDR at the beginning of his administration, right? When I turn on CNN, I see the first 100 days. Well, where does that come from? That comes from FDR because he got so much legislation passed.
Right.
Of course, he was in the middle of a, well, catastrophic economic crisis. There was a lot of pressure. Another leader who got a lot of things done with the same party as Lyndon Johnson. But in both cases, they ran into some, let's call them headwinds from their own party.
It, like what?
Well, I think one of the chief blockers of those agendas under Roosevelt and under Johnson were, of course, Southern Democrats, right? So if you think about the so-called one-party South, I mean, you want to talk about the hazards of one-party rule, just look at the Jim Crow era and see all the things that can happen when you have Democrats in charge of, you know, state and local politics as well as, you know, the governor's houses. But even there, in the heart of the Jim Crow era, there is remarkable diversity of thought. There's deep infighting. You think about conflicts over labor, over whether or not African Americans will have the right to vote, over what urban development will look like. All of this stuff is really the product of pitched battles within these various southern states. So what we think of as the kind of solid South, that agenda of states' rights, of right to work, all of those issues are actually the result of very bitter infighting at the state and local level that, again, we tend to miss when we just think about kind of one-party rule or even the New Deal as a program.
Yeah. And even at the – to go back to the national level, Nathan, mm-hmm. I mean, Roosevelt got involved in Democratic primaries in 1938 because he saw people like Maury Maverick in Texas, who was a progressive. Mm-hmm. He saw Lyndon Johnson, who had
Claude Pepper in Florida.
Leanings. He saw Claude Pepper in Florida. And he said, yeah, listen, if we're really going to promote economic development, progressive programs in the South, we need more people like this. He intervened and he got his clock cleaned, to use a radio-friendly term.
I'm so glad that you just brought up Maury Maverick, because it just reminded me that we were doing the show from San Antonio a couple of years ago and ended up at the Maverick family reunion with dozens and dozens of Mavericks, and it's that family, and they do believe that they are Mavericks, the way that we would use the term Maverick.
They are Mavericks in every sense.
What a fun party. Anyway, let's talk about Republicans and how they have handled one-party rule, because we've been talking about FDR and LBJ. What about Republicans?
Well, in the 20th century, they've had fewer opportunities for one-party rule. But we can go back to Eisenhower. He carried Republicans into the majority in the 1952 election. But he, too, really struggled with this because his majority in both the House and the Senate was paper thin. And the obstacle that Eisenhower faced was a guy who you may have heard of.
Is that Joe McCarthy?
That was Joe McCarthy. And he was just a pain in the neck for Eisenhower. Now, they were both Republicans. And in fact, when the Republicans became the majority in the Senate, McCarthy got a lot more power. He was made the chair of a committee. He got a staff, which included people like Roy Cohn, who went on to advise Donald Trump, as a matter of fact. Mm. But McCarthy was literally tearing down the government with his witch hunts and attacks and charges that there were communists in the State Department. Eisenhower hated McCarthy. But you know what? He did not publicly move against McCarthy, because if he did, it would have destroyed his paper-thin majority in the Republican Party. It would have just torn it apart, Jeremy.
As we look back at the last few presidencies, I do note that every single one of them, going back to President Clinton, has had a period of his presidency with one-party rule, including President Clinton, who was not able to get through HillaryCare, right?
That's right. I mean, Clinton came into office with Democratic majorities in both chambers of the 103rd Congress, right, the House and the Senate. And even though he only won, you know, 43% of the vote, he used that term, mandate, as a way to basically justify a pretty ambitious agenda, right? I mean, the idea, of course, was that he was going to try to insure all Americans. He was going to try to require employers to buy health insurance for their workers. The first problem, of course, was that the bill itself ended up being over 1,300 pages. But then there was a bigger problem, right, where in all this talk about mandate, it again, you know, concealed the fact that there were a variety of different interests who were already inside of the Democratic Party. So you think about, for instance, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which at the beginning of Clinton's administration seems very supportive of the plan. Within a year's time, they're actually turning against the plan, because the idea is that, of course, it's hurting business to force them to have to buy health care. You have all other kinds of countervailing geopolitical concerns. You have international issues in Bosnia. You have other issues that are happening in Somalia and Haiti. And, of course, lowering the deficit takes priority on the minds of many of the Democrats in the party at the time. So all of this basically makes it extraordinarily difficult for Clinton to get anything done in his first 2 years. And as we, of course, then know, the Republicans ride right into the Congress in a very short amount of time, showing in a lot of ways the ephemeral nature of these kinds of majorities.
So as you look back at all of this history, does a president tend to get more done when his party controls both houses of Congress, or when he has to work with the other party?
Well, if you look at Barack Obama's attempt to get health care through, right, it was an interesting move because he also had these Democratic majorities in the House and the Senate. But he basically used a, you know, conservative idea, right? The American Enterprise Institute's, or is it the Heritage Foundation?
The Heritage Foundation.
Thank you. The Heritage Foundation's health care plan, in the hope that that would get the votes necessary to kind of move the thing along. And there are a number of people now who look at that moment and say, well, Obama was at least able to get through the most conservative health care plan that the American voters would accept, right? I mean, so, you know, it's interesting to think about the use of Democratic majorities in this instance to kind of put forward Republican ideas. And of course, as we know, Obama suffered pushback from the outset from Boehner and other conservatives in the House anyway, even though he was using a right-wing plan.
And I would say, Jeremy, that just flat out, if you counted up the important pieces of legislation, yes, it really does help to have a majority in both houses your own party. That said, if we look at the example of Franklin D. Roosevelt and we look at the example of Lyndon Johnson, they burned through that popularity pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Also, a lot depends on the dexterity of the president. Lyndon right. Johnson and FDR, among all presidents, I would say, were real masters of negotiation and deal-making with Congress.
Well, right now we have the person who says he's the best negotiator and best deal-maker. So let's see.
The proof is in the pudding.
And I'll also say that in both Roosevelt's case and Johnson's case, they needed to depend on some Republicans. And I think our deal-maker-in-chief is going to learn pretty quickly that if he's not going to do business with the Democrats, he's really going to be raked over the coals by those factions within his own party.
Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the public radio podcast Backstory. Guys, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Thank you.
And an update now on a story we brought you yesterday. Today, Kansas Governor Sam Brownback vetoed a bill that would have extended Medicaid coverage to as many as 180,000 adults in Kansas under the Affordable Care Act. The Republican-led legislature surprised many by passing that bill earlier this week. Red states like Kansas that had rejected Medicaid expansion are now reconsidering it after Congress failed to vote on a replacement for Obamacare. But Governor Brownback, also a Republican and a critic of Obamacare, tweeted today that the expansion did not prioritize the vulnerable and failed to defund Planned Parenthood. So the battle over healthcare policy continues. Let's turn now to healthcare technology. Have you heard about the miniature organs on a chip? This week, scientists announced that they've managed to create a tiny version of the female reproductive system, complete with 5 organs, small enough to hold in your hand. It can simulate a 28-day menstrual cycle. It's called the Evatar, props to the biblical Eve. It's funded by the National Institutes of Health with research primarily from Northwestern University. Some of the device was built at the Draper Labs. Ike Swetlitz is a reporter for our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. He joins us now. Ike, tell us more about this organ on a chip. What's the goal?
So the goal here is to be able to have a better model of the human body than mice and other small animals, which is what scientists use right now to test drugs. But scientists have been realizing over the past many years that mice aren't just little human beings. So a lot of tests they do on mice don't really accurately model what would happen inside of a human. So they're trying to build these models that they can use to test drugs or study how changing something in one of the organs would impact the other organs that would be more similar to what would happen in the human body.
Right. The realization animals have different physiology, as you write. Of course, animal rights people will be very happy about this. So we have here a woman's reproductive system. What does it do?
So what we have is basically a bunch of little plastic blocks that have little blobs of tissue from the different organs. So you don't have the entire organ, you just have a little bit of it. And the bits of organs exchange hormones in a way similar to how it works in the human body. So hormones will travel from one little block to another little block and then provoke the same response or a similar response as they would in the human body. So it's sort of a model that shows the different chemicals flowing, but not necessarily the sort of physical architecture, the geometry that you would see in a human body.
Right. The tissue from the ovary, the fallopian tube, the uterus, the cervix, the liver, and you can see hormones flow from one to the other over this, as you refer to it, kind of plastic scaffolding. That's the device that's kind of holding them together. And we understand the further goal is to be able to do this organ on a chip with maybe the liver, the heart, blood vessels?
Yeah, so there are teams all over the country. There are researchers all over the world who are working on different organ systems, and the goal eventually to be able to connect them all together so that you would be able to, you know, sort of have a little human on a chip, so to speak.
Yeah, well, and also to customize them to each human so that you could really be, you know, more specific about what that human need is.
Right. So some drugs work one way in some people and a different way in other people. And what these researchers would like to be able to do is to build sort of an evitar or a larger system that's grown from your cells,
right,
so that they would be able to test a drug or something like that on a model of your cells before they put it in your body.
The downside, you're right, some of the concern is, you know, we mentioned animals. Animals will die if an experiment isn't going well. A chip won't.
Right. So I think it's still sort of an open question of how well these will model human beings, right? Because a few of the researchers who were not affiliated with this study who took a look at the paper pointed out that there were some differences between what the sort of organ bits looked like in this chip and what they actually look like in the human body. And in particular, one of them pointed out in the sort of model of the uterus, there weren't as many of a certain type of cell where you would usually find endometrial cancer. So if you were testing a drug in a human, it might lead to endometrial cancer. You might not find that in this particular chip because it sort of doesn't have that feature. Mm-hmm. So I would say that's a limitation right now that the scientists are definitely trying to overcome by building more realistic models in the future.
Well, still pretty exciting news. Although I'm wondering, are there people who are worried about, well, what if there's someday a requirement that everybody has a chip of their tissues and then there's some nefarious use of that?
Scientists aren't worried about things like that yet. I think right now these are more sort of research tools and research models. And I think when it becomes more commercial, then people might start to have some of those concerns. But it wouldn't be worth it to build one of these for every drug, right? Maybe if it was an intensive cancer regimen or something like that, it might make sense to have a personalized chip to test it on. But if it's just how much of an over-the-counter medication to take, it might not be worth it.
Right. Because of the cost. Well, you write that one of the researchers is going to be looking for participants for those stem cells to have custom organ systems built, and that could happen over the next year. So we'll link people up so they can keep an eye on that. Ike Sweatlitz, a reporter with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Ike, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And we'll also link you at herenow.org to a video that STAT made where you can see Evitar at work. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.